This is netstack.fm, your weekly podcast about networking, Rust, and everything in between. You are listening to episode 26, recorded on February 4, 2026. In this episode, we talk with Mauro De Gennaro from Stalwart Labs about how email works in practice, the main protocols involved, how they fit together, and what it takes to build and operate an email server in Rust.
Hello everybody for another week of netstack.fm. We are episode 26 and with me is Mauro from Stalwart Labs, and I'm super excited for this one because it is the first time we can touch on mail protocols and how mail work and really start to understand it. So very welcome, Mauro, as you are the perfect guest for this topic.
Thank you, Glenn.
Despite all the amazing work that you and your company have been doing, and mostly in the open even, and despite the fact that you have given several talks about it, I think it's still a topic that's not being seen by the mass, not even within the Rust community. I think many people know about what you are doing. And so we would like to get to know you a bit better. Can you maybe introduce yourself a bit?
Yeah, sure. My name is Mauro De Gennaro, and I'm the lead developer at Stalwart Labs, which is a company that develops Stalwart and email and collaboration mail server written in Rust. In addition to the server, there are a few libraries, crates available on our repository for different mail related functions. For example, email parsing, authentication, email building, and so on.
Very cool. And like, how did you find yourself in this world of emails? Like, for example, like, how did you get even into computer science or computer or hacking or networking or however you got into this?
I got my first computer when I was in 91, I think. And it was a Commodore 64. At the beginning, I started playing games, and then I wanted to see how those games were made. And I started getting into programming. I got a few books, and I started learning BASIC and so on. In 93, I started my own BBS, a bulletin board system. For those that don't know what it is, it's a place where you used to connect via modem to access files, chats from other computers. Most BBS were single node, unless you had money for a lot of phone lines. With my the BBS allowed me to have my first interaction with the internet, because I wanted to offer email to my BBS users. And back then, the only possibility was the UUCP protocol, which is like an offline protocol that fetches your emails in batches. That was my the first time I used internet. I was through UUCP, reading newsgroups, and so on. During this time, I was also programming. Then I got into C programming, which is my favorite language. Well, now it's Rust, but it is C has a special place in my heart. Around the late 90s, I realized that the only way to see your email online was to get Yahoo or AOL and so on, and if not, get the webmail from Exchange. So I wrote a webmail in C using CGI 1.0 that allowed you to access your mail server, your emails that were hosted either using the Mailbox format and then Maildir and then also IMAP. And after that, I wrote a mail server in C in the early 2000s, something like that. This was like my my first email related company. After that, company was acquired. And then I started a new company that had its own, like a framework to creating business for creating business applications. And I also wrote once again another email server, this time in Java. I don't really like Java anymore, but that was a dark episode in my past. And then after this company, I took some time off to study, do some personal stuff, travel and so on. And after a while, I started feeling the need to go back to programming again. And let's see after so many years, how the email landscape looked like. And I realized that it still looked like 20 years ago. You still have Dubcot, Postfix, Exim, and the same software as always. And nothing had changed. The configurations were really complicated. They were from different people, and they were not really scalable or memory safe. So, and also I decided to change that and start writing an email server in Rust, which, by the way, I had no previous experience with Rust before that point. And I started learning the language by implementing the mail parser trait, which is an email parsing library. And after that, I started creating other crates, then always with the goal of writing the mail server in Rust. Once the mail server was completed, I continued with the collaboration part. And then I implemented every single protocol, email protocol and collaboration protocol out there, including IMAP, POP3, SMTP, JMAP, the new one. If you're not familiar with JMAP, it's a new protocol that is HTTP based that aims to replace almost everything, basically every single email and collaboration protocol. JMAP aims to replace IMAP, SMTP submissions, also WebDAV for files, CalDAV for calendars, and CARDAV, also SIEB, and so on. So it's a new protocol. It's really exciting, and it allows you also to create develop clients much faster, because you don't have to deal with weird protocol stuff in JMAP, in IMAP, sorry. And with JMAP, it's just a JSON request. Yeah, so basically that's my personal story. And I've been doing this for a while. And now Rust is my favorite programming language. I won't touch anything else. Yeah, perhaps a Python script to do something automated task, but any production code, including web-based code, has to be in Rust.
Yeah, I mean, you won't hear me fight that. This decision seems reasonable to me. Personally, I also went through a lot of different languages, and for the stuff I'm doing as well, it's like around networking, around web stuff. Yeah, for me, Rust makes a lot of sense there too. So I understand it. It seems you were dealing with mails like since long, like as you said, from C to Java, and then the origins of Stalwart. You were already writing repos, and then eventually, like at what point did you feel you actually could form a company around that, and then how did that go?
Well, the idea, because I have also an entrepreneur side, so the goal was always to create a start a business from it, because I had done that in the past. Also, I had email related businesses, including email hosting and web hosting companies, as well as software development companies. And the goal was to first start to try, because email, creating an email software company is quite risky, because you're basically reinventing the wheel. So finding investment for that is tricky. So that's why I started doing everything as a solo developer. So yeah, that was the goal from day one. Had to have a mail server and collaboration server, and then expand the company. So and now the Stalwart's a mail server and collaboration server is now is feature complete, but it's not yet version 1.0. The version 1.0 is because now we're in the refinement phase. Like after so many years of almost 5 years of development, there's a lot of things that need to be. A lot of parts of the code that need to be refactored, the configuration needs to be reorganized, the way you configure Stalwart. So, yeah, that is the what I'm at. So after the Stalwart reaches version 1.0, the idea is to expand the team and hire developers to work on the UI, on the webmail, because currently Stalwart only has a web admin, but not a webmail. And yeah, for that, since I'm not really into UI, the idea is to expand the team to have more developers. Currently, it's a small company of 5 people, and most of the employees are doing either sales or support. And also, he made some customization for paid clients. But the idea is to expand the team once the development for the webmail starts.
Okay, very cool. And so, given also the fact that you were always doing email, is your own personal and family email, is that also happening on your own servers?
Yes. Yeah, that is correct.
And that's I guess by now that means you are using Stalwart as well for your own personal stuff.
Yes. Also for calendars and file storage.
Very cool. And so, yeah, I mean, first of all, huge amount of respect. It's like been probably like a long journey. So I imagine it's pretty satisfying to now look back at all the different crates and things you created, because it's coming all together nicely, and the fact that you can dog food it is probably very satisfying, I can imagine.
Yeah, but it's always I'm also get real anxious because I'm close to version 1.0 and I'm pushing hard, so it is released as soon as possible. The goal is to release it this year, because there are a few companies waiting for version 1.0 because all these Stalwart uses Ember, and there are a few, the last few releases have breaking changes, but this is necessary to improve the performance and also reorganize the product. So it would be great to have version 1.0 as soon as possible, so more companies and also families and small organizations can start using it without worrying having to worry about migrating their data when a new version comes out. So yeah, that's the current status.
Very cool. And I can also see that you are getting part of your funding via funds that are established by NLNet, which I guess NLNet Labs, which is also like we had them. Well, it's NLNet Foundation, but they also have NLNet Labs. Like, I guess the company split off, but we had some podcast episodes already with the folks of NLNet Labs. So it's very cool that these funds are also helping projects like yours.
Yeah, that is correct. So the people from NLNet invited me to apply. Some years ago, now Stalwart has received 2 grants, so it really, really helped with the development.
Very cool. And so, in order to start to get an understanding and start to get some road that we can grasp onto as we explore the different protocols and your repositories in more detail. I would like to propose that maybe we can start by, okay, let's say I am from a maybe Gmail server or from I'm using a Gmail client and I'm sending an email to, let's say, you, and you are using, of course, Stalwart. Like, how does it, for example, know to what server to connect to, what protocol to select? Because like you said, there are like newer protocols as well as older ones. Can you help me like uncover this journey of my like connection and email and where it's going to, and then how all these decisions are being made?
Okay, sure. So the first time when you, let's say you write an email and you enter the recipient address, for example, john@example.org, and you click send, your mail client will contact your SMTP server, which is the one you configure while you created your account. So it will establish a connection on port, the submissions port, which could be 567, if I'm not mistaken. And then it will do the handshake, authenticate itself. Usually the submission port requires authentication to obviously prevent open relaying. And the SMTP server, the MTA, the mail transport agent, will will accept your message and place it in the queue, in the internal message queue. And then based on the server policy or how busy it is, at some point it will pick up that message from the queue and it will see, okay, this email is going to john@example.org. So it will take example.org and it will, using DNS, it will perform an MX lookup. It will check the MX record. So on the MX record is located in the DNS server for example.org or obviously or any other domain. And the MX record contains a list of mail servers with priorities. So and the your MTA will start attempting to deliver that message in order based on the priority. So if the first entry on the list is mail1.example.org, it will establish a TCP connection to port 25 on mail.example.org. And this is the simple explanation without any security or authentication protocol, right? So it will then contact mail1.example.org. If there is a problem, let's say the connection is closed, it will try the second one, mail2.example.org. This time, let's say it works, it will say, will issue a hello command, it's called. It will say, hello, I'm this server. I have a mail from this address, and I want to deliver it to john@example.org. If the address is accepted, then the data stage of the transaction begins, and the message is placed in the queue of the remote server. And then this server, assuming that John is a local user, it will take the message from the queue and place it in John's mailbox. And then John, using, let's say, IMAP or JMAP, will connect to mail.example.org and will fetch the available messages, the new messages, and will then see your message. So this is the basic part. So like in the old days, without any authentication, any security, and so on. Then there are a few protocols to prevent spam and abuse. These are MTA STS, DMARC, DKIM, SPF. So, yeah, I don't know if you want me to go?
Yeah, in a bit, because I can see there's like a separation there, because I know you have the mail alt crate, and there you, I think, implement most of them, and I'm not sure all of them, but I see a lot of them defined there. But I can see that, for example, in your Stalwart repo itself, that's where it seems to me that you're implementing things like IMAP, JMAP, SMTP, CALDEF, etc. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're implementing the Stalwart repository in the mail server.
Okay, and so you were also mentioning, okay, you have, like, for example, JMAP, but you said it replaces all the other ones, right? I mean, or it aims to replace IMAP, SMTP, CALDEF, CARDEF, WebDEF.
Yeah, it's an alternative. And so Stalwart offers them in parallel, so the client chooses which one to use.
Okay.
Because you were, JMAP, you were...
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yeah, it's because you were, in your example, you were saying, okay, first we have some activity in the let's say, origin server, and that was done over SMTP, you said, but that's only because, I guess, the user configured to use SMTP. If the user there would have configured JMAP, then I guess it would use JMAP. I guess that's the choice there, I suppose.
That is correct, yeah. So JMAP also can handle email submissions, but the connection, the transport between the two servers is done using SMTP. So,
always.
Always. So JMAP only replaces the client, is the protocol for the client talking to a server, not server to server.
Okay. And is SMTP, is that always, like, is it on top of TCP or is it on top of UDP?
It's a TCP protocol. Yeah.
Okay. But it can go via TLS, no or not?
Yes, that is part, one of the many of the authentication and authorization protocols in the mail auth crate are about that, about making sure that the whole transport security protocol, such as MTA, STS, so they validate they make sure that TLS is using, and then when you connect to a remote server, that you're getting the right certificates, right? Protocols like DANE and MTA STS do that.
Okay. And so something that was never clear to me is, like, how come, like, things like calendar and file stuff is mixed up with, like, mail protocols? Because, I mean, sure, they're both useful, but there are, like, so many different things that you could also, like, do in a mail program if you really wanted to. Like, I mean, what stops you from playing videos in a mail server? Like, what is the origins there? Like, how come these things are so often being implemented together?
You mean emails and calendars and contacts?
Yeah. I mean, contacts, I guess, I can still kind of understand because it's like your address book, I guess. Even though I'm not sure how come there's, like, even a protocol for that, but, like, yeah, the calendar and stuff, I mean, it seems like almost like a complete separate thing to me.
Yes, but they are, although they're separate, but they're integrated. For example, the calendar uses email to send invitations, for example. They use both iCalendar and JS Calendar, use email addresses as the participant identities. And also most users expect the mail servers and also administrators expect the mail server to also handle their calendars. Another reason is that, for example, with contacts, you can integrate the spam filter with contacts. And if you receive an email that is classified as spam, but that sender appears in your address book, the spam filter can learn to retrain to reclassify the message as ham, and then train the classifier so it learns that message is not spam. So it's although they're different, email calendar is not email, It is normal that a server, for example, Exchange does the same. Then you have this Docker container software, for example, Mail in a Box and so on, that do the same. They take a lot of different products and also include a calendar. Some other users, some users also even want like Matrix integration for chats, but that might be too much. For example, now with JMAP and file storage, you could also use Stalwart as a place to store your spreadsheets, documents, slides. But of course, that the spreadsheet and slide functionality will be implemented on the client side, not on the server. With Stalwart now, you have all the tools to have most of your company data, if not all files, calendars. So it is a complete collaboration server. It's basically, of course, you need also like, is your company, Stalwart will never implement a CRM and so on, but it's a core component in any organization for collaboration. So you don't need anything else. With Stalwart, you can handle your email, calendar, contacts, and files.
Very interesting. Does that also mean that, well, I guess if I want to send one of those files as an attachment via mail, then it would still just anyway have to be part of, like, how does that even work? Is it like, if I add an attachment to my email, is it just part of the SMTP protocol or?
Well, no, the attachments, they're different things. So the SMTP is a transport protocol that will send any kind of email with or without attachment. Attachments, if you have a file, let's say you want to attach a file that is stored in your server, unless you send them a link, the client needs to retrieve that file, encode it, and place it in the message using something called MIME, which is a message encoding format. Because back in the day, you could not send 8-bit over a link. It had to be 7-bit, plain ASCII. So still nowadays, we're still encoding messages in ASCII. So message bodies, they're encoded either using BASE64, that we all know, or quoted printable, which is for text. So a MIME message is what it contains is a structure, a nested structure containing the different parts in the email, of the email. For example, usually emails contain a text and an HTML version, so the client can decide which one to display. Then it can contain other parts for the attachments. So, you can split, and also it can contain other messages. So using these nested MIME structures, you can send almost anything you want. It has some overhead, obviously, due to all the encoding, but this is what we have now. And as far as I know, there are no plans to improve that encoding format. There are a few attempts, but so far, MIME is here to stay.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm looking at an example from your mail parser repository, and to me it looks a lot like HTTP, where like the different messages are like separated via this giddy up separator, it seems. And then you have like these headers which define the content type and the content transfer encoding, which is like not exactly like HTTP because they have different values, at least the transfer encoding, for example, quoted printable or something. But yeah, it looks, I guess it's not the most efficient, but it does seem to work and I can see why. What's, by the way, your opinion around like having this HTML versus like plain text, because I always found the fact that you can even do HTML like a I don't know, I never understood the need for it, except for like, okay, it looks fancier, but to me, it always included so much more security risk for so little advantage, because anyway, you're mostly just, content should be king, I would think, and your message is anyway plain text.
Yeah, that is, first going back to what we were, you mentioned about the different headers. So the email consists, an email message consists of headers, which are key values. And then what you were seeing with the boundaries, those are the MIME boundaries. So the boundary is an arbitrary string that it should be chosen, so it's unique, because that is how each part is detected. Then the sample that you were looking at on the mail parser crate includes, it has a text HTML and a text plain part, and it also an attachment, which is embedded in the HTML part. Regarding the use of HTML in messages, is yes, up to the client. I mean, you can always choose what to use. But yes, HTML is the only way. Well, there are other alternatives. It's not only HTML, but it's a common, the most widely used format for emails with formatting. So if you want to include images and have some styling, text HTML is the only option out there that is accepted by almost any client.
Yeah, I mean, I can imagine. And okay. And then, of course, as we mentioned, TLS as one of the authentication protocols and also security, because you don't really want your mail ideally in plain text, even though it's still happening a lot. Certificates are getting shorter, and so things like ACME are more and more necessary. Now, most mail servers do not really implement ACME, and then they would use something like NGINX. But I saw that you do support ACME out of the box, which would allow like a trivial use of a TLS certificate via things like Let's Encrypt, I suppose.
Yes, that is correct. It supports ACME to make obtaining a certificate easier. And also, the next release of Stalwart will allow administrators to automatically upload, because currently Stalwart is able to modify your DNS server to create the ACME DNS-01 authentication records. But the new version would allow you also to update any kind of record related to email, like the MX, the MTI, STS, TKIM, and so on. So,
but you really want that? I mean, often for security, wouldn't it be nicer if I could just have like a single, I don't know, let's say HTTP endpoint and do the HTTP challenge so that my server does not need authentication over my records?
Well, it's up to the administrator. If you don't want the mail server to modify your DNS records, you can also use the TLS ALPN-01 or the HTTP-01 challenge types. The main advantage of using the DNS for ACME is that you can get wildcard certificates, which are useful in a mail server, because you have other domains, for example, MTA, STS. There is also an autoconfig domain, which is how mail clients detect the configurations for an account. So those all these protocols expect a certain subdomain. So by obtaining a wildcard certificate, you make sure that that you don't have to obtain separate certificates it could also be in the same certificate, but there are multiple requests. With a wildcard certificate, you can have as many subdomains as you like with just one certificate.
Super. Yeah, okay. That makes totally sense. I wasn't aware. Like, what's the reason that these Can you explain a bit what these protocols are and why do they need subdomains?
Well, it is part of the specification. For example, the way the protocol is designed. So, for example, the autodiscover, autoconfig. Let's say you enter, John wants to set up a new mail client, and the mail client will ask, what's your email address? He enters john@example.org. And to make things easier for John, the mail client will first try using this autoconfig protocol. And what it does is it takes example.org, which is John's domain, and it adds autoconfig. And then it tries to perform to send an HTTP request to autoconfig.example.org/well-known. Well, it's a path to an XML or JSON file containing the mail server details. So this way, John does not need to worry about what is in the IP address or the host name, what is the port. Is encryption enabled? Is implicit or is through start TLS? A lot of technical details. They are handled automatically. And for this, you need the autoconfig subdomain. So, and then you have MTA STS, which what it does is when the mail server sends an email to another mail server, for example, example.org, it will send a similar request to mta-sts .example.org and obtain the mta-sts settings for that domain. So this file tells that, okay, mail. It will return a list of the authorized domains for the mail server. So if there is a problem with your DNS server, someone hacks your DNS server and adds an entry to redirect your email, that will prevent them from doing that, because MTA-STS will see, okay, this is a list of mail servers authorized to receive emails for example.org, but I see something else in the DNS server. So it means this is something is wrong. The server might be compromised, so delivery is not done. And in addition to that, MTA-STS tells the remote server that your server supports TLS and has a valid certificate. So that's another guarantee. So yeah, going back to the subdomains, those are two examples of domains that you need in addition to the domain that you use to connect. Let's say if you have mail.example.org, you also need the domains for autoconfig and TASTS, and for that reason it's better to use a wildcard certificate for simplicity.
Yeah, that makes totally sense. And I use the different channels myself as well. Sometimes wildcard comes in handy, and in this case, yeah. But I mean, all in all, it's already very cool that if you're using Stalwart, that you can use ACME to begin with. Because, first of all, I don't agree with the registry companies, but like for some reason, and it's beyond me, is that they are reducing the lifetime of these certificates more and more. Like, I don't think it really helps with security, but they seem to claim so. But that does mean that you are coming to a point where it's going to be very painful to manually issue certificates. So the fact that you as an administrator that uses Stalwart do not have to worry about that, I mean, I would think that's like almost like a huge selling point on its own.
Yeah, some organizations use a proxy for certificates, but yeah, certainly by allowing Stalwart to handle your certificate, you make things it makes things easier. Yeah.
And then one, like, even if you don't know about mail protocols, one thing that most developers do eventually learn is that the emails themselves, so the recipients and the senders, that identifier is inherently complex. I mean, some try to do it with regex, which is of course not the right approach, because what can be contained in a valid email and the meaning of how it's formatted is pretty complex. So how are you handling it at Stalwart? Like, how are you parsing the email identifiers? So the email itself.
An email address, basically the trick is by not implementing a historic functionality that is no longer used. For example, an email address can have comments inside of it, inside the actual email address. So that is something that is not used nowadays, and Stalwart will reject them. So you cannot create an account with that. In addition to that, there are certain attacks you can do. For example, you can use confusables, which are a similar Unicode character. For example, an A from used in another language, for example, in Greek, that looks like the A in ASCII, but it's not exactly, it's not the same. So there is a security measure, which is removing confusables.
Is that similar to what IDNA does for domains? Is that the kind of technique you also use for the identifier parsed?
Yes, that is correct. That also is a problem. Like, for example, and there is online like an apple.com domain that is using an A from some other alphabet. So it's an example to showcase how phishing attacks could be implemented by registering domains that look really like the real one, but they use a different they use character from other encodings to confuse people.
Okay.
And then the email address is, if you are strict about it, which is you're validating as a mail server what addresses you allow to create, it's not that complicated, because you just make sure that the top level domain is valid. There is a Rust crate called PSL that contains a list of the valid TLDs. So you make sure that it has a valid TLD and that the domain part is correct, that you don't have like a dot, multiple dots next to each other, or it starts with a dot. So you do that basic validation. And yeah, that's basically it. Also, you need to validate the local part to make sure that the address does not start with symbols and so on. And in the case of Stalwart, it will reject comments. So that is how the validation is done.
But then, of course, some things I would think you cannot really avoid, like, for example, the fact that it can be case insensitive, or that the dots have no meaning, or the plus operator like allows you to add extra like data, so you can like have unique addresses at the same recipient or that things. All these things, do you allow them, or is it also something you just reject?
Yes, the MTP, the SMTP server allows all that. So you can use comments, or you can use mixed case in the local part, which for example, so some temporary addresses and so on use mixed case local parts. So that's allowed on the, you're allowed to send an email to an address like that. But on the Stalwart side, all addresses, they are lowercase for simplicity and also to avoid security issues. Like someone creating an account called admin with a capital A, for example. So for that reason, in Stalwart, as a mail store, only accepts the lowercase email addresses.
Okay, but you do allow Unicode, if I understand correctly?
Yes.
Okay, very cool. So that's already one less worry. And then there was a protocol you mentioned, which is Sieve, like the sieve filter, or how do I pronounce it? Like what is that about, and why is it used?
Sieve is a scripting language, basically, for mail filtering. It's a very old specification, and it's a very limited scripting language, because you don't want people to users to create a script then can like attack your server or cause a denial service, for example, an infinite loop. So sieve does not allow to have infinite loops. So the only loop that you can create is over the mine parts, so over the message parts, which are fixed. You cannot do any other type of iteration. And sieve consists of a base protocol and some extensions to the protocol, for example, for vacations, for regular expressions, and so on. And it's quite simple. So basically it says, if this happens, if this is contained in the header, and then you have some actions like reject, discard, or file into to move it to move the message to a certain folder. Sieve scripts are managed using a protocol called managed sieve or JMAP for sieve. So that is how you configure, how you upload these scripts to the server.
To say it's old, then it has limitations. Does that mean that in some cases it's not even used anymore, or like what was the future of sieve?
Well, no, it is old, like SMTP, but there are no alternatives. It is old, but still used nowadays. It's the only option to do mail filtering. Actually, some email clients, when you have like a rule editor, a mail filter editor with a UI, for example, it says if from matches that, then this to then do this or do that. Many mail clients, well, the only way they have is if they want to implement server-side filtering is to convert those UI, those rules defining the UI into a sieve script. So yeah, sieve is still the only way to do server-side mail filtering. The script is, the language itself, I mean, it's not bad. It's not really nice to look at, but it works.
But how come is the only choice if it's on your server, and if you are writing the server like Stalwart, that's something you just have full control over, no?
Yes, but the problem is that there are two sides on this, which is the mail server and the mail client. And mail protocols, as well as other protocols such as HTTP, are standardized by the IETF, the Internet Engineering Task Force. So each one of these protocols that we use, they have an assigned and what is called a RFC number, request for comments. The HTTP protocol has one, SMTP, IMAP, JMAP, even sieve, all of them have their own RFC numbers. And both clients and servers implement these RFC so they can talk to each other. So I could create my own scripting language, but if it's not standardized, it's not really, it would be hard that clients would implement it, because there is something supported by just one server and it's a proprietary. I mean, it will be considered a proprietary protocol or scripting language in this case, if it's not standardized. So standardization helps adoption, because then you have both servers and clients implementing the same protocol. In fact, there is Stalwart, my server, that is uses a protocol called MTA hooks, which is designed by Stalwart. It's currently a proprietary protocol. It was created to replace Milter, which is a binary protocol created by Sendmail many years ago. And this protocol is a Milter is a binary protocol for filtering. So when you set up a spam filter or a virus scanner on your mail server and you want to talk to it, the most popular, well, probably the only protocol you have to do this is Milter, which what it does is says, okay, I have this connection from this IP that wants to send this email. What should I do? And Milter, this message is sent over the Milter protocol to the scanner, for example, the spam or virus scanner, and the scanner returns a list of actions. It says, and modification. It says, okay, this message, it is spam, discard it or reject it, or if not, you can say, add these following headers to the message. The problem with Milter is that it was never standardized, so it's not a standard, it was created by SendMail. It is informally implemented by mail servers such as Stalwart, for example, also Postfix and Exim, but it's poorly documented. In fact, there are two versions, one of them, there's not even documentation for it. So if you want to use it, you need to reverse engineer the protocol to understand or code that implements it. And for that reason, MTA Hooks was created, which is an HTTP-based protocol. What that is much easier to implement, and currently there is some discussions at the IETF to standardize the protocol. So it's during the next IETF we will start discussing whether if it makes sense to standardize this. So yeah, anyone listening that is interested in this, they can join the IETF mailing list, Mailman Dispatch. To help standardize this email protocol as well as others. Yeah.
Yeah. And I also noticed that you and Stalwart are making several proposals yourself to IETF, and you even have like an RFC repository for that. Are these already proposals that are submitted, or is it for now just happening in the repository?
Yes, currently I'm working on five different proposals. Three of them are for the JMAP protocol. One of them is to add metadata support for JMAP. The other one is to extend the mail, JMAP for mail, to support sharing. And the third one, JMAP related, is JMAP for enhanced references, to use JSON path, to each JSON path, and yeah, to extend the JMAP protocol to do more expressive queries on the responses. And in addition to that, there is another proposal. These JMAP drafts have been adopted by the JMAP working group, so that is good news. It means that now they are on track to become standards. And then there is another standard called Object ID, Object ID BIS, which is I'm working on this standard with Fastmail. We're co-authoring this extension to obsolete the previous IMAP Object ID extension. So this is a draft to fix an old IMAP extension called Object ID. And finally, there is a MTA Hooks proposal, but this one has not been adopted by any working group because it needs its own working group. So in IETF 125 in Shenzhen, the idea is to start a new working group to standardize these MTA hooks. But there's already some interest. A lot of people showed interest, both at IETF 123 in Madrid and also during FOSDEM that was discussed. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed, you were at FOSDEM. I was there myself to give a talk about Rama. Like, how was your experience there and how was your talk received?
Well, this is my second year at FOSDEM. have never attended a FOSSEN before that. Yeah, it was a really nice and rewarding experience. I was able to meet all the client and other server developers, all people involved in email. So, and also before that, the day before, we did an email hackathon. So where we discussed new ideas for protocols, what can be fixed and so on. And the talk itself was, it went well. It's now available on the video recording is available in case anyone wants to take a look at it. It's called Scaling Email. Can open source scale to Gmail scale? So if you can use open source products to run something like Gmail. So the presentation goes over the different, because Stalwart is just a mail and collaboration server. You also need a database server and so on. So the talk goes over that to see how far we are from having something like Gmail and what needs to be done to get to that level.
Mm. That's indeed, I mean, in a way, it should be the the future, right? Because, email is very critical, and yet most of the people run on a Gmail or some other server. That does mean that if for one reason or another their account is suddenly closed or they are locked out, I mean, that's a huge problem.
Yeah, a lot of that is something that I also wanted to talk about, which is self-hosting your email. That a lot of people are scared to do that because there are some horror stories about how complicated it is, how your emails will end up in the spam folder of the recipient, and so on. And I have to say that to those that give Stalwart a chance, because it's now really automated. It's not like before. It will tell you exactly what you need to change, what you need to change in your DNS server to have a fully secure and correct mail server. It will tell you, everything. And also it comes with safe defaults, so you don't have to worry about this safe setting and so on. By default, if you just install it, create an account, and update your DNS server with the records provided by Stalwart, that's it. You will be running a safe email server. The main, of course, is not. You need some Unix experience. You need to know how to connect with how to SSH into a server, do backups, and all that. And there's also another aspect, which is the IP reputation. You need to make sure that you find a VPS provider, a server hosting company that gives you a clean IP that was not used by spammer default. So if you follow those steps, you should be able to regain control over your data, and you will be sure that big companies are not using your emails to train AI models or to sell you stuff. And in addition to that, Stalwart supports encryption at rest. So if you have open PGP or S/MIME, you can upload your public key, and before Stalwart writes the email to your, if the email arrives in plain text, and you have provided a public key, Stalwart will encrypt your message using that public key. So even if the server provider wants to read your emails, they can't, because they're already encrypted with your PGP key. So yeah, and now in the future, there we plan to add implement a new quantum resistance PGP. Version 6, the version 6 of PGP, so you can use the quantum resistance or quantum tolerance, I forgot the exact name, that will make it much harder to decode your keys in the case there is a, if we ever get quantum computer, that and forward secrecy. So once that is ready, that will be available as an installer. But in the meantime, the standard OpenPGP or S/MIME is pretty safe. No one will read your emails. For the time being, you can encrypt them and only you will be able to see them.
Okay. And so, yeah, I do want to dive a bit deeper into that is because I understand the concern, but I also do understand that Stalwart makes it a lot easier. And there are also pretty good guides these days, like about what records you have set, but I guess even Stalwart, as you said, if it has access to your, if it has admin privileges for your DNS registry, even that you can do for the user. But even then, I noticed that despite the fact that you have a good IP reputation, your domain might be already quite old, so it's not a new domain. You have all the correct DNS records, etc. It seems that some big mail providers still give you a low reputation anyway, and you end up in spam folders, like let's say an Outlook server, or I don't know. Like I don't self-host myself yet. We are planning to, and Stalwart looks very interested for that, but. I know some other folks with a lot of experience with it, and they say despite doing everything right, you do anyway end up sometimes in a spam folder without any fault of your own. And it might even be that one day it works fine, and the next day suddenly you send out a newsletter and you end up for all Gmail users in the spam folder. Like, what's your experience with that?
I have a... When the first time I configured the mail server used by the domain Stalwart, our internal domain, we had the same problem, but it was what we did is we tried with a different provider and that fixed it. So, for example, the first one we were using DigitalOcean for the mail server. And that IP had problems. It did not appear on any block lists. So, based on those tools that are available online, it was not bad. It did not have bad reputation. But still, the messages were placed in the junk mail folder this big provider. And the solution was to try with different BPS providers until we found one with. Hesner, we have an IP address from Finland that not for any, that's no connection to Finland, but is the one that was available and had a clean reputation. So, yeah, it is a bit annoying, but it's the only way. It's just trying with different providers, have the server for 1 month, for example, and see how it goes. And then until you find a server an IP address that is not blocked. And another option that some people use is to use a relay host, like, I don't know, like Amazon SES or something like that. So you receive your emails without problems and delivery is done using this relay provider, such as, I don't know, I think MX2Go, something like that. There are other alternatives. There are many alternatives out there for email relaying. And in software also, you can have custom rules. You can say, okay, deliver everything from using my IP, but for example, for msn.com that does not like my IP, for that, use Amazon SES. So you can create custom routing rules for those domains you're having problems with.
Okay. And then, okay, that's, so it seems there is a way and is sometimes you have to look for it, like you have to do some trial and error, but it should be in general a smooth experience. So that's reassuring. My other concern is a bit, okay, you can, I understand you can take backups, like for example, that you don't lose your mails. How you take those backups, I guess, in the end, it's files, so you can use anything, including like things like rsync. I mean, you can really, you can backup however you want to as many different points as you want, but still, let's say I am using Hetzner, everything's fine, but one day the server is dead and I need to, I don't know, move it somehow. And in the meanwhile, I don't receive any emails. That also means if I need to, I don't know, somehow need to receive an email in order to do some administrative work, like for example, to log in somewhere, I mean, I'm kind of screwed, no? Like, how do you deal with that once you are self-hosting, that you have redundancy, that even though you one server might not be working, you still have anyway access to your mails while transitioning?
Well, the good thing is that the SMTP, well, not the protocol, but mail servers by default, if your server is unavailable or returns a 400 code, it means that it's not ready to accept your email at that time. So the remote server will retry to deliver the message. Usually it's around 3 days. It depends, obviously, on the remote server. So if you have a downtime of for a few hours, it won't be a problem because you will receive the email at some point. However, there is if you're really concerned about that, what you can do is have a backup host. You can have another software instance as a backup server that will hold. It cannot, it's up to you. Be used as a mail store, it can be used like as a backup destination. So what I was mentioning before about the MX entries in the DNS server. So you can have an MX priority one with mail.example.org and an MX priority five with or 100, I mean the next one on the list, pointing to mail backup, for example, .example.org. And this happens if, for example, you have a downtime, if your server crashes or you're migrating or doing backup and mail.example.org is unavailable, the email will be delivered to the backup host, to mail.backup.example.org. And then this server will hold the message forever until you connect your main server. And when that happens, it will deliver all the messages that were received on that host. That's one way to do it, having backup hosts.
Okay, that makes sense. Very cool. And how easy it is as a stalwart user to take backups and do recovery. Like can I, for example, take regular snapshots and just pretty much like deploy a new instance like almost instant, or how difficult would it be for me to start from one and move to another because somehow the server or provider is dead?
So Stalwart supports multiple database backends. It could be like for small host or single server, you can use RocksDB or SQLite, and it also supports Postgres, MySQL, and FoundationDB. So the backup procedure depends on the which backend you have. So in Postgres, you create a snapshot and you dump all the tables. And in RocksDB, you can just copy the entire directory. And it's that's very, very simple. So the backup procedure depends on the store you use.
Like it's so I choose a backend and everything Stalwart stores in persistent memory, that's all in that database.
Yes, that is a simple use case because you can then use specialized stores. You can have a blob store, like an S3 compatible store. In that case, you are not backing up the blobs because your S3 store handles usually, you know, for example, if you use Amazon S3, they will handle the fault tolerance, the recovery for you. But if you use a self-hosted solution like Garage, you don't need to back up the blobs. I mean, or you need to follow the Garage instructions for backing that up, or might not even be necessary because the store is handling the replication. For example, if you use Ceph from Proxmox for the blobs, it's part of a cluster. So if one node dies, it's already the data is also available in other nodes. So it depends on the store. So if you only have, for example, Postgres for everything, you need to just back up Postgres. But if you use like a specialized store, for example, for blobs, then you need to, perhaps you don't even need to back up blobs if your blob store is already taking care of that.
Okay, very interesting. Okay, well, you have a way to reassure people that self-hosting is fine. And again, like, I think it's very important. Like, it should really be like I think it's very dangerous how we're relying on these like single point of failure, especially given how crucial email is. Like, it's kind of like as if nobody had their own mailbox in their house, but instead they were all using this central building to receive all their mail. Like, it wouldn't be something you would want, especially for important papers. So it's a bit crazy how we somehow did get into the situation for email.
Yes, yeah. And the idea is to make Stalwart even easier to deploy, because once version 1.0 is available, the idea is to also include it in the Linux distribution. So you can, with one command, you can fetch it and also include it as an option for the different cloud providers, for example, an Amazon image, then also a Hetzner image, that you just deploy it and that's it. Because also the good thing about Stalwart is the person managing the instance is not that familiar with Unix. They can manage the server entirely from the web using the web admin. So you don't even need to SSH into a server. Well, it is good that the SSH to check the hard drive, how they're doing and so on. But if they want, either getting other alerts using a different platform, they don't even need to log in. So because everything that is related to the mail server can be managed from the web.
Okay. Wow, amazing. And then something that's also was not always clear to me is, okay, so far we talked about SMTP, but often when people, I mean, even if they're not experts in mail, but still they might do something basic as choosing what server or maybe like in order to be able to receive email from different domains in their Gmail, they will still have seen at some point or another that, okay, there's SMTP, but you also have what is called POP3. Can you kind of like explain a bit what POP3 is and how it differs from SMTP?
The right protocol to compare it against is IMAP and JMAP, because POP3 is a protocol to fetch messages. It's a very, very old protocol, older than IMAP. And it's very simple. It doesn't support folders, and everything goes to a main place. So you connect and you see how many messages are available and you download them. That's it. It doesn't support synchronization like a changelog or anything like that. So because of those limitations, IMAP was created that supports folders. So you can keep your emails in the server and have different folders. And then there are a bunch of IMAP extensions to make using IMAP better. So they improve the protocol. There's one called Quick Resync and Conditional Store that when you connect to the server, you get a change log. And it says, this is this inbox, this folder has change ID 123, and you download all the messages. Then when you connect the next day, for example, you tell the servers, what are the changes since change log ID 123? and the server tells you what's new, what are the new emails, the deletions, and so on. So you don't have to download everything again. But so I would say that POP3 is the first protocol for mail retrieval. Then IMAP came after that, and a bunch of extensions were created to make IMAP better. And then around 10 years ago, JMAP was created to make email access even better by including everything we learned from IMAP and simplifying it and making email access even more powerful. So it does, JMAP does everything that IMAP does and more efficiently.
Okay, very cool. Thank you for clarifying that. And then something that's okay, we already talked a bit about the fact, okay, why is calendars linked to mail? We talked a bit about how it kind of works. We talked about the base setup. Like in a bit, I want to get into the authentication part a bit more. But before that, next to sending emails, let's say if I'm self-hosting as a company, there are two other use cases that I typically would look for. The first use case would also be, I want to have like, let's say I create like, I have a maybe like a product, the product of the website, and I might want to have some shared inboxes, like for invoices or for support. And in my experience, like in most traditional mail software, that's not very easy. Like, let's say if we would use something like Fastmail, okay, you can create shared emails, but we don't really, that would mean that we receive both the email of, let's say, a support ticket, but we would not really see what the other, maybe colleague might have sent, because in the way they are still separate, so not even sure how it works. Is there a way, if you use Stalwart, that you can like really collaborate fully on a single inbox for certain email addresses?
Yes, Stalwart supports groups. And so when you're a member of a group, each member has access to the same folder. So and they all see the same messages. And this folder also has a group address, a shared group address, email address. So and this folder is then displayed when you connect using your using IMAP or JMAP. This shared folder will appear on your client. So that way you can collaborate with other users.
Okay. And I see, like, because for example, right now we use Fastmail, but for a long time we really want to switch to something like self-hosted. And I see, okay, I see folders, for example, also in Fastmail. And indeed, we all receive, like, we have our own company and all my employees and my co-founders, we receive those emails. But we don't see when someone sends, like, something. So for now, we are just, like, using BCC to make sure the other person sees or what we reply, maybe like to a support ticket or to a partner or whatever. But because otherwise we don't see the sending. Like, is it, can you explain that and why that is that something that you do have that I can also see the sending?
Well, that is something up to the mail client. It's not a server functionality. What is happening here is that the client is placing the send message in your send folder instead of the group folder. So in Stalwart, you have, there is a send folder for groups. The thing is that the client is the one placing the message there. So it's not added there through SMTP. So what I'm saying is that when you send an email over SMTP, the server will not place that message in the send folder. It is done by the mail client. For example, Apple Mail, Thunderbird, and so on. So when you send an email, Thunderbird or any client will send a message using SMTP or JMAP submissions, and then place a copy of that send message in the send item folders. So what you need to make sure is that your client, when you're using the group identity, when you're sending the email as a group, or always, or when you use the any of the group aliases also, that send item is placed in the send item folder of the group and not your personal one. So it's more a client configuration.
And is it when you see like these things like email threads, so where you see like the different emails within the same email threads, does that mean that the reason why you see your email is because it's just visualizing it from the send folder?
Exactly. Yeah.
And but because I'm not using I'm usually even just using their official clients or their web client, and so I wonder why they don't just do it, and I never saw even an option for it. It seemed like a limitation of just that thing. So I'm a bit confused, because what you explain, it seems to be pretty trivial to do. So I'm pretty puzzled now.
yes, it's I guess it's a functionality you will have to request that the message is sent from a group. The sent item is placed in the group and not in your folder.
Yeah, but I mean, much better would just be to switch to Stalwart.
Yeah, but then you depend on the client you use. If you use Thunderbird, you need to make sure, for example, that Thunderbird is placing when you're sending an email from the group identity, that is placing the message inside in the group folder, not your folder. Mm.
Yeah, but at least it's in my control, because now I don't really, well, I guess I could already use a custom client and also have it like that, but I suppose that makes no difference then. Okay, cool. And then I said like there are two use cases I have, so one is these groups, so seems like you cover that quite well. The second use case I would usually have is like I might have some also web application or some other software running, and it might sometimes need to send emails, for example, for two-factor authentication or registration or, I don't know, like a newsletter or whatever. And so is there also a way for me to make, like, let's say API keys or like various scoped accounts like that can then send emails on behalf of some addresses?
Yes, so it supports application passwords. So you can create an account. You can create a special password for another product or client, and the next version 0.16 will allow you to set different permissions or reduce permissions for that application password. So, for example, if you have an email client a tool that only sends emails, for example, like a third-party service that you want them to use your account to send emails as you. You can create an application password and limit the permissions so that they cannot read your emails. They can only send emails, so only submissions.
Okay. Yeah, very cool, because, for example, we also use some invoicing software, and there they also by default use their own let's say address for sending invoice, but obviously it's a bit unprofessional, and so we would rather have it use like our own email address or some custom one, at least at our own domain. But in many places that's not really something you can do unless you make or like pay for a separate user. And it seems like here, as you self-host it and self-do it, and the fact that you support it, that would mean we can actually do that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, very cool. And then the thing like that we didn't, I mean, there are many things we didn't touch on yet, but I was looking to check on the authentication part, but then I also found that you have this other crate, which was called, like, I think it was called Mail Sender, and it's an email delivery library. So I guess that's the one I would use if I want to send emails. and it says email delivery library for Rust with DKIM support. Like, what is DKIM?
So DKIM is a standard to authenticate senders. It creates a cryptographic signature with the contents of your emails. So you can look at them if you check any email that you receive and you look at the headers, the raw headers, you will see a line called a header called DKIM signature. So that DKIM signature is contains a cryptographic a signature of the contents of your email and headers. So, and this signature, the public key is available on your DNS server. So, for example, is if John sends an email from example.org, a signature will be added to the header saying, okay, this is the DKIM signature. It was signed by the domain example.org, and this is a signature. So the mail server will then contact, check the DNS records of example.org, and for that signature in particular, and then will validate the signature using the public key available on your DNS server. So if the signature matches, it means that message was likely sent by you from your domain, at least from your server, because your server is the only one with access to the private key to sign that message. But there are a few issues with DKIM related to forwarding and replay. And now the IETF is working on DKIM version 2, which will fix all those issues. Hopefully, I don't think that will happen soon, but hopefully in the next few years we'll have DKIM 2.
Okay, because as far as I know, DKIM was already supported in the mail auth crate. Does that mean that the mail sender makes use of the mail auth crate?
The mail auth crate is a one. You can sign your messages using MailSend, which links the mail auth crate. Or if you're interested in just signing and using something else for sending, you can use directly the mail auth crate.
Okay. And then, because the mail auth crate is not only focused on DKIM, but also ARC, SPF, and DMARC. And I guess there must be some relationship between DMARC and ARC, given that they have the same ending. Can we get like a quick overview about these protocols?
Yeah, ARC is an experiment. It's classified as an experiment. It's used to when forwarding, when there are intermediary hosts forwarding an email. So it creates a trust chain of all the and all the servers that forward the message keep adding their signatures and sealing the messages. The problem that with ARC is that it has a few issues. It's not very effective, so the ARC experiment is ending. It's called ARC stands for Authenticated Receiver Chain. So DKIM 2 is going to replace the ARC. So, but before that, ARC is going to end, and then SPF is sender. It means sender protection framework. It is also another standard that works with the DNS. So basically, what you do with SPF is you tell senders which are the IP addresses that your domain sends email from. So it is quite not super complex, but it has some complexity because you can include other domains. Create rules and tell the other server what to do. Like if you have an SPF record that says I only send emails from the IP address 1234, and you create a rule saying what happens if that is not the case. If you should is the server should accept a message anyway or reject it. And then finally, you have DMARC, which combines SPF and DKIM to trust the domain, to see how, to find out whether the domain is trusted or the email you're receiving is trusted or not. So for an email to be trusted, that you to be authenticated, that's the right word, it has to pass either SPF or DKIM. So DMARC also works using the DNS, and you say, for example, example.org, and you has DMARC enabled, and it has a reject policy. It means that if the message does not pass DKIM or SPF, then reject it, because it was not sent from my domain. Then DMARC has another extension for reporting, that you can get emails from other mail servers telling you what happened with DMARC, how many messages passed DMARC checks, and how many didn't, and from which IP addresses are sent. So you get aggregate reports every once in a while from other servers with the DMARC authentication results for that period.
Okay, very cool. And then we also have the, is it like a crate? Like the spam filter repository? I'm not sure it's a crate. No, it's more like a set of rules, it seems. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that is used. Those are the rules used by Stalwart mail server, but they're not. It's not a Rust crate. It cannot be used.
Okay. And is there, because these are TOML files, it seems, or... No, rule. No, the list is TOML. Even the rules are TOML files.
Yeah, those are converted. Those are Stalwart expressions that are compiled and tell the spam filter what to do.
And that's then compiled into CIF, or is still something else?
No, in an internal faster representation.
Okay. And then, okay, so that's cool, and I can kindly see how it works. People can look at the rules themselves to understand. Like, it seems pretty easy to read. Now, another thing that is even easier than checking emails about whether it's spam or not is like things like IP reputation and whether the domain is like new or not. These kind of reputation and DNS lookups, is that also something that Stalwart does on behalf of the user to maybe like reject an email from a domain if it's like, I don't know, less than a day old or something, things like that?
Yes, those checks are done as part of the spam filter rules. Yeah, there are a few server DNS block lists that do that.
Okay, because I didn't immediately see that. I also know you have some LLM rule, which is basically just a set of prompts. How is... like Stalwart integrating this? Is it like running it locally via something like Rig, or I don't know, like how are you integrating LLM into your products, and how useful is it really?
Well, yeah, they're quite useful, but they're expensive to run. So if you use like a OpenAI, you will have to pay for the credits, obviously, and that is kind of okay if you have a small server, but if you're running this at scale, it will get quite expensive. So at that point, it is recommended that you run the model locally, also for privacy reasons. Yeah, you need a good hardware that can handle that.
Yeah, but I mean, even most cloud providers provide specific like VPS service for that. So yeah, but I guess it's still expensive, I suppose. But even then, I think as a company, I mean, because so far we were discussing, okay, you can set up host, but you would still so far mentioning like I was using a DigitalOcean, something like Hetzner. But I mean, if you have your own office, like why not just have your own server in your office and get like a static IP from your telecom? Or are there like concerns regarding that? Because at that point you can just have whatever hardware you want. And like to my experience, if you just have a decent individual computers, I mean, that could easily run a mail server which can handle a local LLM without too much cost, and you would have, you wouldn't have to pay any. I mean, it would be truly be self-hosted, right?
Yes, that is an option. But yeah, to receive emails, so you have your data, right next to you. However, many servers do not accept email delivery from residential IPs. So you will need something like a relay host to send emails.
But if you request a static IP for a company from your telecom, is it still seen as residential? I guess so.
Well, no, if you have a commercial IP, then no. But if what you mean is your own home IP address, then it's probably marked as a residential IP. So many servers won't accept it.
I mean, that's a shame because I would think, I imagine like a very, in my pink colored glasses, I imagine a future where maybe you or some other company would just prepare like a plug and play little box that you can just plug into your basement. And now you have, as a family, your own secure local mailbox and, I don't know, delivery system. I mean, I would think that should be like almost like a basic right to protect your citizens.
Yes, but it's due to spam. Many remote servers will not accept your emails. That can be solved by having at a VPS a relay host also running Stalwart that sends your emails. If you're having problems, I mean, if your IP is not marked as residential, then you don't need it. But if it is, you will need a VPS host in the middle.
Could you also just have, instead of like a full-fledged relay, could you also just have a proxy or something? Like an IP proxy where you would just say, I just proxy my or tunnel my raw TCP traffic and it just comes out of this valid cloud IP, but it can be pretty dumb. It doesn't have to do much because it's just relaying basically TCP packets.
Yeah, it could be, it's not supported currently, but it could be a SOX 5 proxy.
Yeah, I mean, I have some ideas around that. And okay, and then I know some, let's say, home lab people, they might be already self-hosting other stuff via their basement or their, like, wherever in the house, really. But then there was the issue, residential, they might not really have a static IP in some countries, or they might have other issues, and so they use something like WireGuard to still expose themselves and have their server being reachable. Is that something that would be easily possible via Stalwart, or that's again like something like not really supported or difficult to set up?
No, that won't work. Something like WireGuard, because the remote server needs to access directly your IP, your server over port 25. So your server needs to be reachable on port 25.
And those ports are always hard coded. Like, it's not like in, because like for example in HTTP, okay, by default it's port 80 or 443, but my host part or authority part, however you want to call it, can optionally contain a port. That's not the case for these mail protocols, you say.
And no, well, you can configure use your own any protocol number, any port number for IMAP, JMAP, but for SMTP, server to server, is only port 25.
Okay, that's I mean, you would expect that you could just choose a custom port if you wanted to, because it's the first time I hear from a protocol where it's really enforced. I know that they have all their reserve ports and default ports, but it's usually just a default. But you are saying that for SMTP, it's not a default, it's just the requirement.
That's correct, yeah.
Okay, fair enough. And so we cover a lot already, and I could talk with you for hours about mail protocols. I mean, I've been learning so much. Is there something that you think we should still cover, or that you specifically had in mind that you wanted to talk about before we start to wrap up?
No, I think we've been really thorough discussed. Of course, there are a lot of details, but I think the listener has a good overview of how it works, how email works.
Yes. And so let's say, okay, there is a listener, and I would think there are some, that hear this conversation and they are now fully converted into wanting to use Stalwart. Like, what would be for them the next recommended steps? Like, how would they begin learning how to use Stalwart, but also they might not really be that familiar with setting up a server or anything like that, but still they are committed, they think is the right thing to do. Are there like resources you could recommend? And then I guess maybe you can think of some later that we could also include in the show notes, like maybe could be books or could be stuff, like where you say like, okay, if you have this kind of knowledge, then you are ready to start using Stalwart, even if you are new to the game.
We'll include the link, but is there the Stalwart repository, stalwartlabs.com/stalwart, or the website. From there, in the documentation, there's an installation, getting started section with all the steps, what they need to do to download Stalwart, how they can do it, and how to install it.
Very cool. Well, in that case, Mauro, I thank you for your time and the fact that you wanted to come talk a bit about how email works, which is, despite how important it is to us all, like very much a black box to everybody. And our goal at NetStack is to have education around protocols and unpack them and ensure they're no longer a mystery, because they are really foundational to us and we have to get a better understanding of them and know how to use them correctly. So thank you for that and for all the work you've been doing all these years.
Sure, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
NetStack.fm is brought to you by Plavio, building secure, open, and resilient infrastructure with Rust, protocols, and purpose. This show is also made possible by Rama, the open source networking framework. Plavio offers service contracts and welcome sponsorships to keep building and supporting its ecosystem. The theme music of this podcast was composed by DJ Mailbox. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform and leave a 5-star review. It really helps others discover the show. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you next time for the next handshake.